Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hello, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, your host this week. Today, we'll hear a bit about how a newspaper juggles fast-evolving news issues and decides to go deeper on an issue that might become a very big deal. We'll hear about how the United States Department of Agriculture has set the table of expectations for the 2019-20 North American crop and markets. We'll hear about how managing forages and forage science are developing to provide producers with more, better balanced, and increasingly resilient crops. But first, let's look into the heart of the Red River Valley to see how farmers there are taking knowledge and systems from west and south and customizing them for the unique challenges of trying to do minimum tillage in the Red River Valley's heavy, rich soils. I attended the first Red River Soil Health Summit and discovered that you can indeed get farmers to leave their machinery sheds, shops, and offices in the preceding season if you hold an event that seems highly relevant and worth it. For a couple of hundred farmers and agronomists, the summit was worth it. And this is how organizer Brunel Sabarin summed up its focus for me.
So soil health, I think, has been on a lot of guys' topics. So when people think soil health, it can mean a wide range of things, but to a lot of people, it's zero till, it's not disturbing the soil the least amount possible, blah, blah, blah. But here in the Red River Valley, in our heavy clay soils, we've been a lot slower to adopt things like zero till. It's more of a challenge because we grow a lot of residue, we are in a floodplain, so it presents its unique set of challenges. Now, when we first, zero till first came out 20 or 30 years ago, or late 80s, early 90s, they tried to make it work out here. They couldn't because of the amount of residue that we had would just leave too much of a mat on the ground that it wouldn't dry in the spring. But we've come a long way since then in terms of our understanding of how soils work, the equipment that we have, fine-cut choppers, residue management from at harvest is vastly improved from what it was. We've got new tools like vertical tillage that do shallow incorporations of residue, help size up the residue, incorporate it a bit so that it starts breaking down to get some of that black soil up. Things like strip tillage that maybe is the best of both worlds, where we're only leaving a third of the soil, or disturbing a third of the soil, leaving two-thirds of it untouched.
Yeah.
So we're getting that black strip of soil that dries up early in the spring that might allow us more timely planting. So, GPS guidance is another one. So we start looking at controlled traffic farming, minimizing the compaction that we're doing on the fields. 80% of the compaction usually happens in the first pass. So the first tire across the field in the spring, that's where 80% of the compaction happens. So if we can eliminate, if we can go from compacting or driving over 80% of the field in a conventional tillage scenario with things like controlled traffic, now we're only tracking 10% of the field, so you're allowing that soil to stay decompressed. All that we talked about, the pore space, the soil structure, lets the water through the soil, lets the soil breathe better.
And it sort of shows, the rest of the prairies can have one sort of approach to this often. It's very different down here in the valley, isn't it? Like, as you were mentioning, and we learn often a lot more from North Dakota than we do from out west.
Sure. I mean, the fact that we're on a floodplain, like the next closest thing to what we have here would be the Regina Plains.
Yeah.
I always laugh because some people say Saskatchewan is flat and there's no trees, but I compare that to where I grew up here in the Red River Valley, and we're flat, no trees, so.
Yeah, yeah. And how did this event get going? How did this get formed?
A couple of us had gone to a couple of conferences down south. So the Conservation Tillage Conference in North Dakota, set up very similar to this, the way this one is set up. So realize it's not just about zero till that they're talking about, strip tilling, minimum tilling, incorporating it into conventional practices. So we thought it might be good to get everybody together here to just share ideas and start talking about, okay, this is the way we've always done it in the past. Is there a better way to do it? What would that look like, and where do we start? So,
yeah.
I think one of the common themes today is going to be, you don't start widespread adopting a practice. It's going to take years. there's going to be years of adjustment. There's going to be a steep learning curve to it. But I think part of the message, too, is start small. Start with the problem areas in the field where there's salinity, where there's water, the drainage issues, where there's compaction issues, and build from there.
Yeah, like Nate was just saying, right, with those headliners and stuff where you just can't do anything really now.
Yeah.
It's worth it.
Stop throwing good money after bad, you know, and there's nothing that's going to grow there.
Yeah.
Why put any inputs in there? Stop spending the money, number one. Number two, any kind of green cover, any kind of growth is better than no growth in that kind of a situation, because anything you can do to draw the water table down is going to let rainfall do its job of leaching away the salinity in that case.
That's the situation in the Red River Valley. It's still pretty dull, gray, and brown out there across Canada's farmland, pastures, and hayfields. But soon everything will be greening up. As a tribute to this season, I offer you these words from Geoffrey Chaucer, the 14th century English poet. "One that April with a shewer sota, the drucht of March hath perced till rota, and bothered every vine its switch liqueur, of which virtue engendered is the fleur. When Zephyrus ache with a sweeter breath, his spirit hath in every holt and heath the tenderer croppers, and the younger son hath in the half course y runna, and smaller fowls mak in melody of the slape and all the neath to the open ye. So pricketh him nature in her courages. Then longen folk to go on pilgrimages." That was the beginning of the prologue to the Canterbury Tales in Middle English. You can find numerous modern English versions of the poetry online, and I recommend you check it out. It's beautiful. Cattle producers are keen to see the land greening after a long winter and, in many areas, a dry 2018. Grazing is an ancient practice, but the management of pastures, plants, and animals is very much a science that is still evolving. Cattleman Magazine has a lot on this subject right now, and editor Lisa Gunther joins us to fill us in a bit on what they're looking at. Hi, Lisa, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for having me.
So you've got a lot on forages and forage management. Why such a focus in this issue?
Well, it's really the season. This is the time of year when producers are planning their forage rotations and getting ready to turn those animals back out to pasture. So,
and tell me, you did an article yourself on an interesting forage. Can you tell us a bit about it? I don't even know how to pronounce it. What is it, and why is it worth people looking at?
Yeah, so it's Sandpoint. I actually had to double check that myself, the pronunciation. And it's not really a new variety of legume. They've had varieties out for well over 30 years. But the advantage of it is that you can include it in a pasture with alfalfa, and because it contains condensed tannins, that reduces bloat in cattle, which is a big problem with alfalfa. So Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada has actually been doing quite a bit of research, both in developing new varieties and looking at grazing practices so it persists in the stand better than it has in the past.
And how do you get it in the stand?
Yeah, well, you would just seed it as part of a pasture blend, most likely. But the problem is, if you seed it with alfalfa over the years, alfalfa tends to persist in the stand more than the sandpoint, or at least that's been the case with the older varieties. So then that bloat risk increases again with cattle. So
yeah, so you got to be aware that just because you put it in, it might not be there in a few seasons.
Yeah, I think around 5 years is when it tends to decline, depending how it's managed. But the good news is, first of all, there are some newer varieties out that do seem to persist a little bit better under grazing pressure. In fact, AFC has released a new variety just this year that was selected under grazing conditions. And the other thing is, if producers defer grazing until later in the year, that actually helps the plants, the sandpoint plants, reseed themselves. So if, you know, about probably every 3 to 5 years, well, just depending, you kind of want to do it before the sandpoint population declines. If you can delay grazing until the sandpoint seeds have set, then you'll have better results over the long term.
And are there any, you know, environmental conditions, drought or, you know, extreme heat or extreme wetness that can affect how the two different plants react?
Yeah, so Sandfoin has been developed in the brown soil zone, so it has tended to be, you know, more adapted to the drier areas of the prairies. So that's something to keep in mind when you're looking at including it in a grazing mix. That being said, it should do fine wherever you can grow alfalfa. That's according to AAFC's recently revised booklet on managing sandfoin. But the other thing to keep in mind is, of course, when it's when you're trying to get it to reseed itself through this deferred grazing, if you do it in a really terrible year, like, it's going to be like any other plant. If seeding conditions aren't great, then it's not going to reseed itself as well as you might expect. So.
And in the magazine, you also have an article on, I think, drought-proofing your feed stocks. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so it's actually a review of from quite a range of researchers and scientists and extension workers. So it goes through everything from kind of picking the right seeding mix, so including some drought-tolerant species in your pasture mix, to seeding annual crops, to kind of planning ahead if, you know, in July, if you know you're facing a drought, and that's probably the time to start looking for hay rather than in November. So yeah, it's just kind of a range of practices that producers can look at to start drought-proofing now, whether or not they have a drought this year. It's a good idea to have some pastures that are better adapted to those dry conditions, I guess.
Grazing animals is been an ancient practice and something we've done as humans forever. And yet, it looks to me like the science is still really evolving and almost in an early stage. Is that the sense you get?
Yeah, I think so. It seems like producers and researchers are pushing that practice further and kind of fine-tuning it. Things from, you knowing how much of the plant to leave, to how to set up their pastures to kind of optimize that so that they're not just overgrazing, but actually rebuilding the soil in many cases. So I think it's really an interesting field to cover. Just because there does seem to be a good synergy now between producers and researchers on that topic.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Lisa.
Great, thank you very much.
Lisa Gunther is editor of Cattlemen magazine. And now we turn to Lisa's colleague at Cattlemen, Piper Whalen, to talk about an article she wrote for the magazine, which deals with pairing your forage with soils and other considerations. So hi, Piper, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So can you sum up for us a bit of what you were looking at? There were some interesting things there that producers maybe aren't always thinking of combining when they're looking at what to put on their land.
Right. So this story sort of looked at the idea of having goals to improve yield and quality when you're planning your forage production program. And a lot of this has to do with considering the elements that are also very specific to your operation. So not necessarily looking at something that might work in a different region of Canada or even in a different part of your own region. So yeah, it's very specific to kind of what works right where you're at.
And I thought it was interesting how what you write about to some degree is about how you need to match your soil with what's going to be growing on it, not just grow maybe what you think would be good to grow, but look at what's going to do best on that particular bit of land.
Yes, definitely. So the expert referenced in this article gave an example of producers in Nova Scotia, and there's some farms there that may have up to four different soil types. So it's necessary then to have the more specific and detailed soil maps to make the best forage production decisions, even from like one field to another. And as well, the idea also of getting your soil tested every 2 to 3 years, because you just given different climate factors, things can change, and also what you've been growing might affect the soil as well. So it is good to stay on top of that and then find out specifically what will work based on what you have.
Yeah, because you can quite profoundly change your soils. You can build them, you can deteriorate them, all depending on some of your choices of both what you grow and then how you manage it, right?
Yes, absolutely. So they found that when using different three-year perennial forage, such as a legume, on a field can add more organic matter, good nitrogen to a field than just growing an annual crop over and over again. So the idea is about mixing, making a plan that utilizes forage to help bring back the soil content and the organic matter, because it's very easy then if you're just always using an annual crop to bring down the soil quality.
I wonder how many producers soil test that often. I mean, I can't imagine it's universal by any means.
I don't have any information on that, but I imagine lots of people do it once and perhaps think that that's it. But yes, the idea of doing it regularly, especially when things are changing. For example, as referenced in the article, they're finding that with some climate change on the east coast of Canada, the growing season has increased by 3 to 4 weeks. Winters are more variable. So there are things happening, and it's just good to stay on top of it. And you never know, things might have changed in your soil.
Well, thanks very much, Piper, for joining us today. Piper Whalen is a writer with Cattleman Magazine. There are lots of issues in agriculture today, and news organizations have to weigh them and juggle them. Some are breaking news. Others are issues appearing on the horizon. Recently, I was part of discussions with colleagues at the Western Producer about how to balance some issues that were simultaneously breaking, and I've asked my editor, Brian McLeod, to join us to chat about that. Hello, Brian, and welcome to Between the Rows. So, Brian, what we were talking about a few weeks ago was it was one of those weeks where there's a lot of news happening. There was this ever-ongoing China crisis, which is taking a lot of our time. But there was also a federal budget, and unlike a lot of federal budgets, this one actually had stuff about agriculture and rural Canada in it. And at the same time, a couple of reporters, including Robert Arneson particularly, were very keen on doing more about African swine fever before it erupts in North America, if that happens. And I thought it was an interesting example of a newsroom having to deal with multiple issues at the same time. And I was just hoping you could, you know, give the listeners a bit of a sense of how as editors in this newsroom, you go about, I guess, figuring out what to cover, how to cover it, and how much to cover different issues when they're all happening simultaneously.
Mm-hmm, sure, it's an interesting time to be in ag. You add on top of those issues the Alberta election, which is also featuring a lot of ag news, unlike some of the other provincial elections. So we have to make sure we get a lot on that. First thing you do is you always try to ask yourself, what do the farmers want to know? I try and keep that question in mind when we go into our editorial staff meeting on Wednesday mornings. When the farmers sit down and open the paper at their table or wherever they're reading it, what do they expect us to have information on that they may not have read elsewhere? And if you keep that in mind when you're discussing things, it helps you identify issues. So when something like African swine fever comes up, we had written about it in the past, but we discuss it with the reporters around the table, and as we all sort of toss in our points of view, it becomes evident that there's a lot to this, because everybody can bring a little bit to it. They'll mention something we've done in the past, or, you know, I think it was Barb Glenn that mentioned in the meeting the fever can come across the borders in chilled meat and on, you know, scraps, that kind of thing. And you think, well, that's how it can get here. And sure enough, the CFIA says that. So all this comes out, and you realize the scope of the issue, sort of evolves in the meeting. And so you realize, well, then if we're just going to it's not really worthwhile just touching on this. We really have to give the farmers the full breadth of the context and why it's important. So then it comes to the top as a priority when you're thinking about what to cover. That sort of bubbles it to the top in the priority.
I thought it was an interesting example, too, you know, balancing the African swine fever, where we weren't just responding to news that was breaking and you sort of have to cover it reflexively, but you're deciding to do stories looking forward that you didn't necessarily have to do that week. But you're deciding that that's worth doing, you know, before it's, you know, it's just before you're just responding to events, you're setting the table for the issues that people need to be thinking about. At the same time, we're doing the kind of breaking news on China where things are happening and you're hitting it quickly. And then, like you say, the Alberta election and the budget are things that have happened, and you need to cover those and make sure the reader has what they need to know about.
Sure. The Alberta election is interesting, too. We watched elections in Saskatchewan and Manitoba that really did not contain a lot of great agricultural news. It didn't seem to be a major issue. But in Alberta, it's a major issue. Both sides are featuring strong ag platforms, have taken different points of view on various things. And so we know that some of those issues can spill over to other provinces. So we decided in that editorial board meeting to say, look, let's cover this in depth, because we know this can come up in other provinces, or maybe it hasn't, and it should. So this gives us a real look at the provincial aspect of ag as opposed to the federal aspect. So we came up with, though, and we spent about half an hour or so, or maybe not quite that long, but talking about potential stories. I think we came up with a list of 10 or 11 stories in that meeting to cover on the Alberta election in agriculture. And then we have to make sure we've got space, because that's always an issue in the paper. So our news editor, Bruce Dick, kept track of that, wondering, you know, how much further we can go and what are the key issues are. So we have to balance that with the space and other issues. So, and we have a lot of readers in Alberta. So we have three reporters in Alberta, too, covering ag full time, that they can provide information on agricultural stories during the election that, you know, maybe other outlets really can't. So we have that responsibility, we figure, to our readers to do that.
I thought it was interesting, too, trying to sort out, you know, there's only one editorial per week. There's only, you know, a handful of columns. And when there's multiple issues that might be worth the paper or people at the paper having a viewpoint or perspective on, you've got to decide as much what not to write about as what to write about.
Sure. A lot of it is about trade-off. We have a good fortune of having some very learned reporters who have a lot of experience and know their background. And so you can take advantage of that. But sometimes you're going to have to decide, okay, for now, something's going to take a background while you focus on this. And that's where the editors come in. That's really where they come in. The discussion about what's out there and what's important involves all the reporters, but ultimately you have to make a decision that, okay, this week we're going to focus on this, because, you know, you get that sense. I mean, you know, glyphosate, for example, is one of those ongoing issues that rears its head every few months. And you have to decide, is this the time for us to go deep on that again, or is this issue that's come up, you know, something that's really just more of a running narrative and can wait a little bit. So all of that goes into the decision-making. When you're seeing with editorials, you need to, you know, we wrote an editorial this week on why we would continue to take meat from Poland, which has African swine fever. And, you know, it's a good debate. And it was an issue that was raised in the stories and dealt with really well in the stories. And so we have an editorial board meeting, you know, discussing things, discussing the various points of view, and then we offer our point of view. So it really is a process that goes through all the reporters, the editorial board, the editors, where things are discussed in depth. And as the more you do that, the more certain issues arise to the top.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Brian, to lay a bit of this out. I think a lot of readers and listeners wouldn't always realize just how much of a balancing act there is and how much juggling goes on. So thanks for taking us through a bit of that process.
No problem. It was a pleasure.
Brian McLeod is editor of The Western Producer. And now for an update on the markets, we turn to Phil Franz-Workington of Commodity News Service. Hi, Phil, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for having me.
So I understand there was a USDA this week.
Yes, they had their monthly WASDE report, World Agriculture Supply Demand estimates. So that was, a lot of hype leading up to it, as all of their monthly reports. Not too much came of the actual numbers, but it's there. They have new numbers to work with now, and the markets will move on from there. Watching the carryout numbers are always a big one on these reports. So they raised the wheat and corn estimates for both the U.S. and world supplies at the end of this marketing year, while soybeans are going to be a bit tighter.
Were there any real shocks, or was everything close to expectations?
Yeah, I think for the most part things were within line with expectations. I think the one that corn might stand out a little bit there, with larger than expected world supplies. At least they upped the ending stocks forecast from 308.5 million tons last month. Now they're pegging it at 314 million, so about 5.5 million tons more. That's that was at the top end of what people were guessing. So at the same time last year, world corn ending stocks were 340 million. So 314 is nice and modest in comparison, but still more corn than people had expected. Wheat as well. They upped their expectation on world wheat supplies to the carryout, 275.6 million tons from 270.5 million in March. So that's up about 5 million on the from the previous forecast, but again, still a bit tighter than last year's 281 million ton wheat carryout. They also revised some South American production numbers, because they still have their harvests going on down there. So the Brazil's soybean and corn crops are a bit higher than originally expected. Argentina's corn crop was revised a bit higher, but the soybeans in Argentina were left steady from last month.
And was anything in the report likely to change what U.S. farmers decide to do here in the next few weeks?
No, not this report. What will change what they do in the next few weeks will be the weather. Like they keep getting big storms down there with snow and rain and what have you. That's going to be causing delays. And the talk is always whenever there's seeding delays, it'll be cut into corn acres and seed more soybeans. So that's kind of that play right now. That how many corn acres will move into soybeans instead because of delays in seeding. That said, even if it's a million acres in the 300 plus however many millions of acres they have in the U.S. Arable land, it may not amount to a grand change. And then yields and weather throughout the growing season will become more important for that. Still watching the trade talks as well, if any kind of big developments happen before seeding gets underway in a big way that could impact seeding intentions, although unlikely big swings one way or the other.
Yeah, there have been many new China rumors this week. I know every single week we're just talking about the China situation, and it seems to only very, very incrementally develop in any sort of a way. Is there any new scuttlebutt this week?
Yeah, this week feels to be a slow week on China news there. People are talking on the phone and teleconferencing, and you hear reports from day to day on, you know, we're optimistic on a deal will be reached, and then the next day it's, oh, nothing's going to happen until next month now. So it's a constant back and forth, and that's with the U.S.-China talks. Canada's got their own dilemma. Our news doesn't seem as optimistic as their news. I haven't really heard any real concrete developments, if anything's going on with Canadian trying to ease the canola situation there.
And pretty soon all we're going to talk about anyway is weather.
Yes, exactly. That's once the snow is gone and fields start drying up, and yeah, it'll all be the weather through the next few months.
And what are you hearing, Phil, about, I asked a question on Twitter a few days ago to farmers about, are you, you know, planning to change any of your canola acreage plans because of this China situation? What are you hearing among the trade about that? What are people guessing farmers are going to do? Are they going to change any acres? Or are they just going to stick to rotations and do what they do?
Yeah, I think there's, I don't know what you're hearing from your Twitter response there, but the general sense I've been getting is that, yeah, we're upset, and yeah, it'd be, we're going to reduce canola acres, but at the end of the day, yeah, the rotational issues and the fact that there's not a whole lot of other crops that are promising, there's no silver bullet crop that is going to replace canola, so yeah, sticking with rotations might see canola acres down a bit from last year, and maybe not living up to some earlier expectations, but it'll still be the 1 or 2 with wheat as far as what gets the most acres in the ground, and it'll still be fields of yellow canola across the prairies.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Phil.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Phil France-Workington is with Commodity News Service. That's it for another edition of Between the Rows. I'm Ed White, and I was your host this week.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.